Hope Books presents Schism, written and read by Bruce Elgin. This book contains mature situations, including violence and intense fight scenes. Listener discretion is advised. Chapter 7. Brian twisted in his chair, one of the older and least ergonomic in the whole squad room, as he scribbled in the notebook. His find nut job to-do list included research, homeless shelters, fiancé. Next to his book was a small stack of phone message sheets. Each one was from Dr. Susan Weston. He was glad that he hadn't given her his cell number. He thought a moment, remembered that he had given that number to Jessica, the ex-fiancée. That had been automatic, something he'd done without realizing it, as if another part of him had taken over and talked to her without his conscious mind being in the room. It had felt good. He hadn't really figured out why, but it felt good to speak with her. It was more than her looks. There was something in her personality or presence that made him feel more like himself than he had in a long time. He leaned back, tried to shake some of the stiffness out of his neck. It was nearly 10 p.m. He'd put off dinner about as long as he could. But that meant eating alone, trying to settle into bed alone, and having the same dreams before he woke alone. He could shove the hunger back for a bit longer. He had done it for 2 years. He picked up the stack of messages. What was it about the doctor? Aside from the red hair, which was too much like Claire's, there was something else about her that put him on edge. And she had tensed when he told her that Adams had escaped. Was she frightened? That would be understandable, but Adams would have to go back to the hospital to have the opportunity to attack her again, and she'd be surrounded by people there, easily protected. And why would she worry that he would come after her again? More importantly, why had he attacked her in the first place? Adams had no history of violence, and then he suddenly picked her as a target. Attacking her simply to escape didn't make sense. It was a minimum security facility. He probably could have broken out without her badge and keys. There had to be something else. Knowing why Adams attacked her might tell Brian why the man escaped, which is what he really needed to understand. Knowing the motives always made the perp easier to find. He understood that every criminal had a worldview, a set of explanations for what they did. They were sometimes stupid and ill-reasoned, but they were valid to the criminal, formed by his experience. What Brian needed to do was find out more about William Adams so he could see this worldview. Then he'd have a much better idea how to find him. He added another line to the list, revisit doctor. Brian nearly jumped at a shout from the next cube over. God, just listen! It was a woman's voice. He put his pen down and eavesdropped. One of the other detectives, also working late, replied, you said the suspect broke one of the other perp's arms? It sounded like Cray. The woman's voice again. Will you listen? Jesus! The guy who attacked you did it. He wasn't the one who attacked me. Her retort was cut off by a telephone. Rios. Yeah? All right. Yeah, fine. Rios' voice sounded tired and annoyed. We'll be there, just wait. The phone clicked back into its cradle. Slinger with a broken arm and a limp just checked himself into the ER at Mercy. Thank God, Cray said. Might not be an all-nighter. Rios prairie-dogged up and peered around the room, his eyes resting only briefly on Brian. He lowered his voice, but it still carried right to Brian. Mickelson's here. Brian could feel Cray's groan like it was reverberating through the floor. No. It's just a statement. Rios stood again, leaned over the wall between them. Hey, Brian, got a favor. Brian decided to make the other detective work for it. Yeah? Assault, single homicide, suspect about to go into surgery. Can you take this woman's statement? No biggie. He took a deep breath before standing. No biggie. He circled to their cube and was rewarded with a slap on the back. Rios and Cray grabbed their things. Miss, this is Detective Mickelson. He'll take care of you. Ling, May Ling, is that such a hard name? God! Brian hid his smile from the departing detectives as he sat at their computer. He put out his hand. Ms. Ling, I'm Brian Mickelson. You all right? She sighed as she obviously sized him up before shaking. Look, can I just go? There's no point to this. Brian sat, waited for her to go on. He'd seen Cray and Rios interview witnesses before. All assumptions and interruptions. They interviewed everyone like a suspect, which didn't work. It took patience. time for the answers to come out, and waiting for her to answer put off dinner, sleep, and the dreams. He was fine with that. Finally, she started up again. "You cops don't listen. Those two kept asking about the wrong guy, the one who killed the bad guy. He was the good guy." Brian let that sink in for a moment. "One good guy, two bad guys?" "Yes, thank you." She eased back into her chair. "He's the one who saved me." "From what, if you don't mind?" Her mascara was smudged from what looked like tears, and the shoulder of her button-down was torn, but she looked mostly unscathed. "Rape? Probably murder? What do you think?" It was stupid to take that way home. Brian waited, looked at the flat computer screen as her tense fidgeting leveled out to wary tension and quiet. She took a deep breath. "Anyway, he's 6 foot tall, thin, pale, probably 30. Hard to tell. I just know I wouldn't card him. Was dressed all in gray and black. Looked really out of it, like he chewed Prozac or Valium for dinner. Kept looking around like he heard something down the street or something." Brian looked away from the keyboard to her. 30-ish? 6 foot? Thin? Short dark hair? Yeah. Did he speak to you at all? A shrug. Not much. Whispered. His voice was kind of hoarse, like he didn't talk much. It was a stupid idea, but Brian stood anyway. Hold on a second, please. Long shot, but hold on. He went to his desk, pulled out the photo of William Adams. The squad room door creaked as Brian sat back down with May. She barely glanced at the picture. Yeah. He stared down at the photo. No shit. He's not a bad guy. He showed me my son. Brian froze at the words, tried not to let her see his discomfort. Your son? My son. My dead son. I was taking the bad ways home, but he showed me my son. Told me my son wanted me to be safe, to be alive. I know it sounds goddamn nuts. He helped me. He barely had time to process, to push away the image of his own son before a voice boomed out. Mickelson! He turned. Hayes stood in the aisle. The lieutenant jabbed a finger at his office. Now! Be right back. Brian followed Hayes into the office. Hayes didn't even give him time to breathe once the door was closed. What the hell are you doing? What? Is that your witness? Hayes asked. No, Cray and Rios's, Brian said. Hayes snarled. Then what the hell are you doing talking to her? They had a perp at the hospital. I'm taking her statement. What's the problem? Brian asked. Hayes only turned it down one notch. They're working a murder. I don't want you near it. Do you understand? Brian turned his attitude up in response to the opening. He didn't need to fake it much. Hayes's meaning did make him angry, but he knew a little drama would redirect the conversation. Time for the I'm not ready routine because I help out the other detectives with one little interview, one bad evaluation, and I'm on the injured reserve list forever? I didn't need a psychologist to see what was going on with you, Brian. I've got real work on these damn fires I'd love your help with, but I can't use you like this, Hayes said. Hayes's voice had calmed, but lacked the patronizing edge it held earlier that day. Brian decided it was best to keep pushing. Hayes could easily figure out what he was up to if given the chance. I was doing the work, clearing the cases. How could I have been in such bad shape? Hayes was silent, the only confirmation Brian needed. You want me to find the escaped inmate? Fine. I'll catch him, and then maybe you'll let me have some real cases. Hayes watched him. You're going to catch him by showing his picture to their witness? Brian looked down at the photo in his hand. Trying to put Hayes on the defensive had only worked for a moment. The lieutenant had spotted what he was holding and hiding. Everything inside him fell quiet. If he told Hayes what she'd said, he'd lose the case, and probably be dumped onto another pile of bullshit work. But if he took the risk and lied, he could prove he was up to the job by handling a bigger case than Hayes knew. Her description was similar. And? It was a stupid idea. He walked out before Hayes could lay into him more or spot the lie. He crossed the squad room and sat down next to the woman. Tell me again what you saw. Tell me everything. William clutched hard at the tangle of tarp in his hand. The texture of the cloth and the pain radiating from his elbow kept him focused, away from the fog. But sleep still pulled at him. His body ached. Legs, arms, back, all were sore and demanded rest. Those muscles had barely moved for 2 years, and today he had sprinted over half the city and pulled himself up onto the top of a building. It was tempting to let the fog take over and melt the pain away. He didn't want that, but the need to rest was becoming irresistible. As he eased off into sleep, the fog formed over him and brought the memories with it. He stared at the smoke rising from the building down the street. As he did, William's awareness itched at him, and he felt himself both on the street and curled on the tarp at the same time. This wasn't just a memory or dream. He hadn't been bothered with dreams of the fire since he'd taken the pills. Why were they coming now? Were the voices bringing them to him? The images pulled at him, tore his attention away from the objective thoughts, away from where he lay in the abandoned building. He was on the street, staring at the smoke. Jessica stood next to him. "What is it?" she asked. "You have to go," the hunter said. "They need you," the caretaker said. The voices started down the street without him. "Will?" He turned to Jess. If only he could explain. "You cannot tell her," the advisor said. The advisor stood firm. William looked between them. "Please, just wait here. I'll be right back." He gripped Jessica's hand quickly and sprinted down the street. The first screams hit him when he was still two blocks away. He sped up and scanned the outside of the building as he ran. Flames crawled from some of the windows, but no first responders had arrived yet. Maybe he was in time. He worked his way through the first two floors quickly. The flames were lighter and most of the apartments had already emptied. But when he touched the door at the top of the staircase, it surged with heat. He dropped to the floor and kicked at the latch. The door slammed open as the flames first sucked in the breath of fresh oxygen and then spit out a plume of heat over William's prone body. He rolled over and crawled forward, stopped at the first door. The advisor stood there, flame folded around and within his fog-filled body. Empty. The next one. William continued forward, wrapped his shirt around his palm, and grabbed the knob at the next door. Locked. The hunter stood near him. "Hit it," he said. A quick nod to the hunter and William dove forward, buried his shoulder into the smoldering door. It cracked and swung open, the top hinge broken, leaving the door at an odd angle in the apartment's living room. Inside, a family of four was huddled together under the smoke. "Go!" William pointed toward the stairway down the hall. The parents urged their children forward and William pushed them all out of the apartment. "One more," the advisor said. The voices pointed down the hall, into the deepest smoke and fire. William scuttled his way to the door, barreled through it without testing the lock. There was a man on the floor, arms stretched toward a bedroom door. The caretaker stood over him, smoke-filled eyes locked on the door and what lay behind it. His wife and child. They're gone. Help him. William grabbed the man and quickly hoisted him up into a fireman's carry. It would make staying low harder, but he could probably hold his breath through the smoke until he reached the lower floors. As he rose, he caught a glint of metal and glass on the floor. A watch. "Take that. He will need it," the caretaker said. William snatched the watch up, and with a final breath of relatively clean air, he ran out into the hallway. He twitched awake, his body nearly afire with pain. William blinked back the threatening return of sleep, grabbed a handful of tarp to anchor himself again. He knew it wasn't a dream. The voices were showing it to him for a reason. Though it hadn't been the answers he'd wanted, nor come when he'd asked, the voices had finally replied. The one vision of his past had shown him two things. More fires were coming. That was what he needed to protect Jess from. He was sure of it. He let himself relax for a short moment. He'd been through fire before. If he could watch over her, he could keep her safe from it. And the vision had shown him a second thing. He now knew who the man at Jessica's apartment was. Chapter 8. Jessica held her hand out for high fives as the children filed out of the room. 5, 6, 7. "Have a great lunch. Eat." She signed along and counted the 8th clap. One more. She waited. It would be Jimmy. He was trouble. She closed the door and wove her way through the small desks to her own at the head of the class. She stepped behind it and sat in her chair. There it was, breathing, just behind her. She spun the chair and spread her hands out, eyes and mouth stretched wide for the little boy. "Bah!" His laugh was loud and off-tone, but filled with joy at the surprise. He reached out and tapped a laugh into her hands. "Go, you'll be late for lunch," she signed to him and spun him toward the door. She listened to his small feet scurry to the exit. The door opened with a wave of noise from the hallway, then closed. Jessica sat for a moment, listened to the wind in the windows, the creak of pipes in the old brick building. She reached into the desk's bottom drawer, pulled out the portable recorder. She settled it in her hand, thumbed rewind, then play. "Hey, Jess, just a quick note to say I love you. Note done. Bye-bye. William's voice sank into her. She played it again, then leaned her head down onto the recorder. Damn it, she thought. She sat, tried to push his voice out of her mind, but it wouldn't move. 5 knocks at the door in a rhythm she knew, shave and a haircut. Jessica patted her eyes dry and dropped the recorder back into the drawer. Sarah, she signed. 2 more knocks, 2 bits. Jess rose and met Sarah halfway to the door. Sarah rubbed a thumb across Jess's cheek, lifting away another tear. The front desk was large. It seemed to Dr. Weston that its age and stained wood gave it authority, a sense of purpose and ability. Predictably, the woman behind it had none of these. The receptionist put the phone down and Weston blew out a breath as she waited. "I'm sorry, ma'am. No answer," the woman said. Weston stared at her. "Then I'll just go upstairs and leave a message in person." "I'm sorry, ma'am. No visitors upstairs without an escort." Weston's hand jolted with pain as she tried to gesture in frustration. She settled it back down. "Just tell him I stopped by." She turned before the desk clerk could answer and started toward the large outer door. As she walked, her eyes scanned the lobby, the people milling around, the large stairs. Then she saw the man walking down the stairs, his face buried in a file. She turned, stopped in front of the stairs, and waited. He hit the bottom step, looked up, and stopped cold. He closed the folder and she saw his hand gravitate to the watch again. Interesting, she thought. The behavior bordered on obsessive. It was obviously some sort of unconscious comfort to him, a panacea for some weakness. "Detective, you haven't responded to any of my messages." She watched his attempt at a calming smile. "Doctor, good to see you up. Are you sure you should be out of the hospital so soon?" "I'm perfectly able to manage my own care, thank you, Detective." She didn't return the smile, though she knew he expected it. "My calls?" His smile faded, which was fine. She didn't need the social pretense, not when there was work to be done. "I've been a little busy trying to find your patient, Doctor." He glanced at the exit and took a step that way. She followed. "And what can I do to help?" He turned to her, obviously had to think about the appropriate answer. "Help?" He took another step and stopped. "All right. William Adams is schizophrenic, experiences auditory and visual hallucinations, correct?" Hearing that he only had more questions could be annoying, but her level of patience was an easy element to control. "Yes." "What specifically did he see and hear?" She felt her patience stretch a little tighter, a little closer to breaking, so Weston took in a slow breath. She would have to keep a tighter lock on her frustration if these were the types of questions the detective would ask. He obviously didn't know just how important it was to find Adams, and she wasn't about to inform him, but he could at least act like this was something of a priority. "He was nonspecific in the interviews I had with him. He always insisted that the voices were gone. Why?" He continued walking. "What did the voices tell him to do?" Weston blew out a short breath before answering. "His fiancée reported that they told him to put himself at risk, typical of some types of schizophrenia." "Anything else unusual?" he asked. "No. He's been essentially non-responsive the whole time he's been in our care. Both conventional and atypical antipsychotics produced a heavy sedation and did little to treat the negative symptoms in his case. Do you understand what that means?" He nodded at her, but she doubted that he understood half of what she'd told him. She could have been clearer, explained that Adams had been withdrawn and that the side effects of his drugs only made it worse, but the detective needed to know his place in this round of questioning. He was supposed to be providing her with information. "Any idea why he attacked you instead of someone else?" Mickelson asked. She made sure to answer quickly, to keep her voice even. "No idea. I assume I was in the wrong place at the wrong time, so to speak." He pushed open the doors. "All right, thank you." Weston followed, kept her voice in check. "I think you misunderstand me, Detective. What can I do to help you find him? How do such basic questions help?" "The more I understand about him, the quicker I can find him." She saw there was more. What did he know? She might have to step a bit more carefully around this man. He was useful if he could find Adams, but that was all the detective was needed for. "Detective, I've been out looking for him. Don't you at least want to compare notes?" she asked. He finally stopped. "You've been out looking for him? For the man that attacked you?" She saw exasperation on his face. "Dr. Weston, do not do that." He pronounced each word of the last statement distinctly, as if he was speaking to a child, and Weston had to stop herself from sneering at him. "Why not? He pointed the file at her. The move was too direct. Rather rude, she thought. The one thing we know about him is that he reacts badly to you, Doctor. I don't need you putting yourself in danger and complicating the situation. He turned away and started walking again. Just let me do my job, Dr. Weston. He hurried down the street. For a moment, Dr. Weston considered following him, but the throb in her hand slowed her. She would have to work without the detective, find William before he did. Brian hauled his growing stack of books to the next shelf, his eyes glued on the slip of paper with the scribbled call numbers. His first crack at internet research after interviewing Mei Ling had brought up a trove of generally useless garbage. Too many crackpot sites devoted to ghosts and spirit channeling, nothing based in research, nothing that would help him figure out William Adams. It was something he'd always been good at, putting his mind in the place of another's, seeing through their eyes and being able to predict their actions because of it. He'd used it extensively over the last few years. It had not only given him the best clearance rate in the department, but the time spent in the heads of murderers had meant less time thinking about Claire and the baby. He'd been able to go hours without having to think his son's name. But then Hayes had thought he was pushing himself too hard and had pulled his caseload, and Brian had been left with nowhere to spend his time but in his memories. At least until this William Adams case had grown into something that could pull him away. First meeting Jess, then when Mei Ling had identified William as her savior, and finally talking with the doctor again this morning, he found himself more and more interested in why Adams had escaped. He knew he could start to see the world from William's point of view, would be able to distract himself further and catch the man that way. But he needed to research first, and the web had been useless. The research materials at the university library were another story. He thumbed across the call numbers and pulled out another to add to the growing stack of books on schizophrenia, religion, and mental illness in other cultures. Brian was sure he'd find something here to help him understand William, to help him catch the man. Then he could convince Hayes that he could handle the real cases again. After that, the work, the exhaustion would begin to fill up and replace everything else again. He could go numb with the work. Hayes had been wrong. His psych evaluation had been wrong. Brian hadn't been trying to kill himself. He wouldn't have minded if that happened, but that hadn't been his goal. He'd simply been trying to fill his mind with something before it could focus on thoughts of his wife and son and what had happened to them. Work had done it for him. Work could do it again. He scanned across the books on the shelf above him, searching for the next call number. Dr. Weston locked the car and hurried into the mental hospital. The jostling of her hurried steps produced a marked increase in pain from her hand, but it was nothing she couldn't put aside. After a check for messages, she paused as she opened the door to Mary Gingrich's new room. She stared at the young woman, who was thoroughly sedated and still strapped down to the bed. She started to check the hallway to see if anyone was there, but stopped herself. She didn't need to worry about anyone coming in or seeing her here. That was irrational. It was an urge she could easily overcome. She turned her attention back into the room and closed the door behind her. For a long moment, she stood at the foot of the bed and stared down at Mary. Years of methamphetamine abuse while suffering from severe bipolar affective disorder had caused so much damage to the patient's brain that Weston knew the young woman would never be truly functional. Not on anything other than a rudimentary level. The young woman could feed herself on good days, but the drug had eaten away at the interior of her brain and severely damaged her ability to process emotions. No matter what Dr. Weston did, this patient would never be whole again. Susan sat on the side of the bed, her broken hand cradled against her chest. Much of this was really Mary's fault. Dr. Weston knew that she wouldn't have been upset at the young woman if not for the outburst in the day room. She'd been able to control herself for years, but hadn't been able to stop herself from punishing Mary after the kick to the chest. The unbroken fingers of her left hand slid under the covers, moved up Mary's thigh. She stopped, pulled her hand out, away from Mary. That wasn't necessary. No matter what she thought she needed to do, that wasn't necessary. "We need to talk, Mary." She forced her hand onto Mary's fingers, squeezed them gently. "I should say I'm sorry, and I am. We both need to work on keeping control over ourselves. I was upset after your outburst, but I won't use that as an excuse." Her eyes wanted to turn to the door. She wouldn't let them. There was no one there. She knew that. "We can't let William tell anyone, can we? I need to find him before that detective does. She stood, walked back to the end of the bed. I'll have to find him and keep him from talking. This is author Bruce Elgin. Thank you for listening to Chapters 7 and 8 of Schism. Please come back next week for Chapters 8 and 9. You can listen to audio on my website, bruce-elgin.com, or as a podcast on iTunes. You can also read Schism on wattpad.com. And if you don't feel like waiting the whole week, you can get Schism in either paperback or ebook format wherever you like to buy your books. Thanks so much. Talk to you soon.